Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire at occultofpersonality.net. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. A Cult of Personality podcast is also available on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, and all the best podcast apps. This is episode number 169, featuring an interview with author Gordon White about his recent book, The Chaos Protocols, Magical Techniques for Navigating the New Economic Reality. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. I'd like to remind you that although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs for me to bring it to you are significant. Your financial contributions make sure the free podcast goes on. Please support A Cult of Personality by joining the membership section or by donating via the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. And if you're already supporting the show or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks, and I salute you. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structure training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the Law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Now, in episode number 168, an excellent interview with author Gordon White about his recent book, The Chaos Protocols, Magical Techniques for Navigating the New Economic Reality. The years since the financial crash have seen the realization dawn that the great promise of modern civilization will go unfulfilled. Study hard, work hard, buy a house, retire happy. It's all a lie, spun for the benefit of a tiny elite. The richest 85 people on Earth have as much wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion. Each month, the numbers change, but they never improve. magical and spiritual discourse has failed to keep up with this new reality. The Chaos Protocols aims to fix that. Join Gordon White as he shows you how to use chaos magic not only to navigate these trying times, but to triumph as well. Discover how to become invincible through initiation and wage the mind war that will keep you moving toward what you really want. From sigil magic to working with spiritual allies, the Chaos Protocols helps you act on the unwavering belief that your life should matter and you're not going to let something as trifling as the apocalypse get in the way of it. Gordon White runs one of the leading chaos magic blogs, Rune Soup, at runesoup.com. He has worked nationally and internationally for some of the world's largest digital and social media companies. Gordon White appeared previously in a Cult of Personality podcast episode 162, talking about his recent book Starships, A Prehistory of the Spirits. As before, this new episode with Gordon is densely packed with detailed Q&A about the contents of his book, and he graciously abides. I've done my best to provide you with a quality, in-depth examination of Gordon's work in his two recent books because I feel that his work is extremely relevant. Enjoy. Gordon White, I want to welcome you back to A Cult of Personality podcast. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us this evening and discuss your most recent book.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you. So tonight we're going to be talking about the Chaos Protocols, magical techniques for navigating the new economic reality. Brilliant book published by Llewellyn. And boy, I've just got so many questions for you about it. So I just will launch right into them. You spend a good portion of the beginning of your book discussing the current world economic situation and how we arrived at it. Could you just summarize your perspective and why you think it's important to understand it?
Well, yeah, sure. So the current sort of economic environment that we're in is probably only about 20% cyclical. So it's 20% boom and bust and 80% something else. And that something else is a fundamental transformation. So once every couple of centuries, it seems, something like this happens. And there are a number of forces that are impacting this sort of fundamental change. It's the rise of automation. It's the sort of onboarding of all economic activity into stock exchanges and indexes around the world. And finally, it's the demography of the largest economies on Earth, in particular in Western Europe and the United States. So we're kind of in the very early days of an industrial revolution, and that would be the thunder and lightning I mentioned earlier, because I live in a vampire cartoon.
That was a great timing.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about the end of the world, and yes, in fact, I should have just said I have sound effects on my laptop here, and I'm just going to press them like a radio DJ. The next one will be maybe someone hitting a donkey. I don't know.
Excuse me.
So when it comes to how our situation is addressed magically, there are probably some things that may or may not have worked in the past, but certainly will not work moving into the future. So magic at a sort of broader level, or at least practical enchantment, is effectively probability enhancement. So that's all well and good, and that should in theory work, you know, anywhere and everywhere, because it's probably some kind of underlying consciousness effect. So it should work on Mars. But if we are optimizing probabilities that either will never have the outcomes that they used to in, say, the 70s or 80s, if we're doing that, then we're not really positioning ourselves to, we're not positioning ourselves for optimization. And as a result, I kind of had to really start the book, I guess, with sort of a slap in the face with a wet fish, just to kind of wake people up as to where we are. And it's not like I'm not particularly apocalyptic. I actually think Well, I went to pains to show that there is opportunity in transition, because there certainly is. But that opportunity isn't evenly distributed, and it's probably in areas that we don't know yet. So we have to learn to look. I mean, the most desirable jobs in the year 2025 don't exist yet, and that's not that far away.
Yeah, it definitely seems like a time of transition. It's hard for me to articulate, but to understand this difference between what a wealth magic book that people are used to and what you've written here, which is something far greater, in my opinion.
Well, so funnily enough, when my editor at Llewellyn, Alicia, and I were going backwards and forwards about what this book would be, because I sort of initially said no when they approached, and not out of a Llewellyn judgment, obviously. It was more, I don't have a how-to book in me. I don't really think that's my road, and I feel like we have enough of them out there. And so we sort of went backwards and forwards saying, well, what would I write about? So I'm not going to do a how-to chaos magic book. And so we're spitting topics. And I said, I'm not going to do a money magic book, because money is a subset of thinking about the world in a different way. And it's not even a wealth magic book. I've kind of coined a term for it. It's a success magic book. It's a book of probability enhancement, essentially. Now, the thing about, you know, money or wealth is that it does give you that optionality to chase after the things or achieve the things you want much easier than if you don't have it. There we go again with the lightning.
Yeah, emphasis so, added.
Exactly, it's brilliant. You know, thank you, Thor. So I kind of understand what you're getting at there with its struggle to be categorized, because I call it a success magic book. So the chaos in the title, The Chaos Protocols, is a reference to the world we're in rather than magic. So it's a magic book written by a chaos magician rather than a chaos magic book.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction. Maybe we can get into that a little bit later on.
Sure.
What do you see the shortcomings with regard to the whole materialistic worldview?
Well, materialism isn't particularly good at describing material. So I'm surprised it has persisted. Well, I'm not surprised it's persisted for as long as it has in popular culture, because it has been deliberately pushed. There are, you know, you end up with kind of really murky funding behind the likes of atheist groups and academic departments. And there are a number of, you know, fairly scary reasons in the background as to why that would be the case. But if you actually talk to philosophers, materialism hasn't been a sophisticated position to take for decades. And I mean 40 years more. So we're kind of stuck. I guess people who might watch a Kardashian program are stuck assuming that's true, and then everyone thinks it is, when it's not just, you know, magicians and mystics who find it absurd. It's actually people who do philosophy. So it's inert. There's nothing in it. It fails. It's very easy to knock over. You actually only need one piece of evidence. So that kind of the black swan effect, you need one piece of evidence that demonstrates that there are other mechanisms of action beyond the physical in the world, and the whole thing falls over. Mm-hmm. We have about 120 years of, you know, verified, replicated laboratory experiments that demonstrate that. And we also have just our personal experience of things like very common psi effects, like telephone telepathy and all these kind of things. So it's there to be dismissed. It doesn't even need to be fought. It's kind of like a guest who got too drunk at a party and kind of overstayed his or her welcome. And it's just kind of weird that they're still there. And that's sort of how I view materialism. And funnily enough, if we don't, well, let me put it this way. There is considerable magical upside to kind of increasing your philosophical sophistication or awareness of the different kind of philosophical schools that are out there, and being able to defend them. So I also don't particularly like panpsychism. I'm okay with idealism. I prefer and tend to defend animism, but it's because I went on this Goldilocks journey through these models at a fairly involved level, because once you get there, there's no getting the toothpaste back into the tube. Magic becomes, especially from a chaos magic perspective, it becomes a lot easier to perform in a practical enchantment sense, because you're not fighting this very flimsy but dominant monocultural assumption. So, and you know, this is kind of what we used to do, certainly in the classical age. If you look at great chunks of the sort of grimoire tradition timeline, that ran through monasteries and ecclesiastical schools, where they learnt Plato and they learnt Aristotle, and they actually engaged with the philosophical and metaphysical ideas.
Oh my God, yes. I mean, the very fathers of Western esotericism were the ones translating Plato and consumed by the arguments of the one and being.
Yeah, absolutely. But even outside the kind of the rain shadow of Florence, you have, Trithemius was a monk, I'm pretty sure. If mm-hmm. not, he went to a seminary. So even the guys who are out there with the quote-unquote bad books, they're in monasteries. They're part of the church infrastructure. And to be part of that church infrastructure, you've gone through that church training. You've gone through Augustinian philosophical schools, and you know how to think about creation in a metaphysical capacity, and you land on an informed opinion. If if you don't want to get burned alive, you land on the approved opinion. But nevertheless, a lot of them, from a metaphysical perspective, certainly if you head east rather than to Rome, from a metaphysical perspective, a lot of them are quite sound, and we don't do any of that. Don't do any of that at all. The kind of last gasp of it was, in fact, the middle class Victorian magicians of the 1890s Renaissance, 1880s Renaissance, and only because so many of them went to public schools and Crowley dropped out of Ivy League, but you have people who studied classics when schools still taught classics,
right?
So they got a light hand, they got a light version of it, and this is the piece. This is kind of at the bottom of the Jenga stack, and it's something that we. We can blame culture and say our culture has failed us, and in some respects it has. But by the same token, we failed ourselves because, as I was just saying to Jason Miller last night, as a matter of fact, these books, like the complete works of Plato, are available on your phone for free. There is no excuse. And I'm just plucking Plato out of the air, the Platonic form of Plato. You can find these things, and these were the ideas that allowed magicians to think about things like what is a spirit and how might sorcery work and where does a human fit in these things. And they don't necessarily need to be right. You come through the end of reading and thinking about it better because you've gone through that exercise of thinking about it, which we don't. And honestly, materialism falls away like cake in the rain. And once that happens, you're kind of three quarters of the way to performing magic, even before you step into the circle.
Wow. I can't really echo what you said any louder. I mean, all of those opinions I completely agree with. The emphasis on the classics, learning philosophy, having a firm foundation in those subjects. I mean, you're right. In order to practice magic, if that's really, really the best place to begin, if you have the time and the energy, because that's going to provide a level of sophistication that you just can't get in magic how-to books.
Or you'll spend less time arguing on Facebook as well.
That's always good.
Because if you look at the quality of metaphysical speculation in the modern magical world, it's not very good. And when I say modern magical world, obviously we have to do the caveat thing. I'm talking about Western European magic and its subsets, because if you go to China or somewhere, they're nowhere near as dumb as us when it comes to that kind of thing, and they have a bit more of an understanding of their own kind of philosophical backgrounds as a generalization. And you look at it and people arguing, you know, classic ones like the psychological model versus the spirit model, and people, I hesitate to say they solved it, but people smarter than you and I, Greg, were thinking about this in the 300s.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is not a new...
Yeah, before there was Facebook. Before there was indoor plumbing, they had figured this out.
Yeah, they developed ways of thinking about it and contextualizing it. And so for me, this is where it comes back to the chaos magic thing. There's an expediency to it, which is, well, do I need to spend 15 years arguing with people I don't know on the internet about things that aren't ever going to move the discourse forward until they incorporate some of these ideas? And the answer to that is no. And so for me, step one is materialism, and I think the cleanest and sort of shortest way of doing that is looking at psi results and paranormal, you know, data. But once you've done that, you're kind of in this world where all these things happen. And I mean, I talked to Dr. Kripal about this because I think, you know, phenomenology is as close as a modern school can get to saying the A word animism without actually doing it. But once you are forced to absorb non-materialist data points, you have to go on this quest. And my recommendation is this quest, well, and obviously yours, Greg, my recommendation is this quest should take you through classical modes of thinking. You don't have to stay in them. I'm not trying to turn anyone into a Platonist. I'm not even really a Platonist or any of that stuff. But you have to go through the journey. And that just seems like there's an opportunity there that few people take up because they want to know why their candle magic spell isn't working. And and funnily enough, my prescription in that case would be just what we described as well. If the candle is lit, the candle is working. So you're going to have to look elsewhere for the leak.
Mm. That's a great one. Wow. I could spend all night talking about this, but, let's see, what is quantum abuse and what are the advantages and disadvantages of connecting traditional magical concepts to modern science?
Yeah, so quantum abuse is twofold. The first one is it became kind of faddish, or the kind of shyster way of pretending you've done what we've just discussed is to put the word quantum in front of something. Now, some things can be quantum. I mean, I think quantum effects scale up, and I think that there is a way of modeling how a lot of things like telepathy work by thinking about that. But that tends to be not what people do. And that's step one of quantum abuse. If you want to get interested in the kind of edge of physics, that's, you know, highly encouraged, but just dropping the word in front of it. And the other one is, when people do this, or when you most commonly see quantum effects or quantum theory invoked in a magical environment, they're invoking the wrong thing. They're invoking the wrong implication. It's the many worlds hypothesis, which is an egregious violation of Occam's razor, which suggests that to sort of solve the wave particle duality, that at each point an entire universe splits so that the particle is still a particle and it can't ever not be. So it's what they do is at every, you know, microsecond, everywhere in the universe where these, you know, when this duality happens, an entire universe is created. So in order to save materialism, in order to prevent the idea that we have to move the official discourse to say that there are some things that exist non-materially, that there are aspects of the universe, probably the majority of it, that exist in a probabilistic non-physical state, people have this many worlds hypothesis, and we just kind of ape it because we think it's like that movie Sliding Doors, and that's not at all what it means. Like, the many worlds hypothesis does not mean there are other dimensions. There are other ways to model that, and there probably are. The many worlds hypothesis is specifically an absurd and childlike and completely unscientific, because it's unfalsifiable guess and a hope that you don't notice because they've thrown in a whole bunch of science words, that they're trying to defend materialism in the face of evidence that breaks it.
Hmm. Thank you.
No, I like rounding on materialism wherever possible, but I live in a city where a lot of people read The Guardian, so I've gotten good at it.
Yeah, I bet. So do you see advantages and disadvantages of sort of connecting magical concepts to modern scientific ideas?
Yeah, this goes back to the metaphysics thing we were talking about. In both cases, you're dealing with the proverbial finger pointing at the moon rather than the moon.
Mm.
When we argue about what is a spirit, it's the same, like, is it psychological, it is in your head. The very first ontological question in the universe has not been satisfactorily answered. So, yes, I do think there's value in it, as long as it is done in such a way that you're building a metaphysics rather than seeking to explain one with the other.
Oh, yeah.
They don't go sideways. And that's one of the things that keeps me interested in magic and science and fringe science and ufology on an ongoing basis, because there are data points out there that invite modeling. And I'm fairly omnivorous, or dare I say promiscuous, in where I can get this information from. And so, yes, I do think there's value in it, but it's not because you're looking for an explanation. You're not trying to find how – you're not trying to go, ah, look at me, I solved how magic works. Money, please. It's not – that's not the goal. The goal is to make your universe bigger and with more question marks in it, especially once you've dispatched materialism. And then you are living in the sorcerer spirit world.
Yeah. I like how you put that, sort of like to using science to kind of inform your metaphysics. I think that's a much better way of approaching it.
Well, yeah, because you get caught in an infinite loop, because otherwise you get caught in the Arthur C. Clarke loop, which is you can explain science with magic and magic with science, and you still explain nothing.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that a good illustration of that might be, you know, the whole idea of science trying to explain exactly the mechanism of life itself. And it gets to a certain point and it just can't make that leap.
No, and its metaphysics and its worldview is so, well, the official materialist reality worldview is so poorly suited to the task that it either pretends it doesn't exist, which it does with consciousness, or just hopes you don't notice. And we can fall into a variant of that trap.
Mm-hmm.
And that reduces your effectiveness as a magician. So you're kind of in an ongoing state of modeling and remodeling your own metaphysics, or at least you should be. And it's fun. I know if people haven't really found their own parts of science that interest them, it's because, and quite rightly, you know, they have horrific memories of high school, and science education is designed to make you extremely disinterested in science. And if that, you know, if that was an actual plan, then they have succeeded.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, these are interesting ideas. You know, sort of going back to more classical ways of learning that, we are forced to revisit now that we're older.
Yeah, it's interesting in the last few years how the kind of creepy neighbor sheen has completely gone from homeschooling, to the point where if I had kids in probably half the countries in the West, I would be investigating how I could homeschool them.
Yeah, right.
You just look at it in the medium term and go, what? What? That's not even learning. And yeah. That's the bad news. The good news is, as we said before, this information has never been available to more people at lower cost in all of history.
Yeah.
So it's a glass half full situation.
Yeah. Let's take advantage of it. So how would you define what you say is, quote, true, unquote, initiation? And what do you mean by becoming invincible?
So for me, there are a number of challenges with how we see initiation in Western esotericism today. And it's mostly because we had, again, coming back to the 1890s, we had groups sort of doing their own off-brand DIY masonry. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't, one, there was, so we've got this 120 years where we think initiation is important for magic, whereas you go back from 1880 to 200, and it's not there anywhere. Like, you know, you don't get initiated into grimoires, you don't get initiated into being a cunning man. You certainly have, you know, information passed along, but you don't have to wear a fruity apron and talk to someone who you day-to-day called Gary, who's currently wearing a Thoth mask. None of that is really in it. So that being said, they can work, but there's nothing inherent in, there's nothing inherently magical in the initiation ceremony so much as it kind of sets off a flare that attracts the attention of the spirit world. And that's what that's the kind of difference between true initiation and how it's performed ceremonially in the West. And I must stress, exclusively in the West. There's a video of Dr. Stephen Skinner on YouTube talking about how initiation works in China, or in parts of China. And you kind of move up to the next, what we would call a grade, once you can demonstrate that you have been able to summon and bind that particular class of spirits, and then you get the next lot of spirits with the next grade, and you move up. So there's no one in the human world. You don't get caught in the silly politics that broke the Golden Dawn at the end of the 19th century, because the initiation comes from engagement with the spirit world, and it's binary. You either did or you didn't, and you move up to the next level. Now, we haven't organized our system in the last 120 years to match that. Perhaps we should, but, you know, that's out there. So when we're talking about initiation rituals, I'm talking very specifically about the world that we're in rather than the actual world. So becoming invincible is what happens once you have been quote-unquote truly initiated. And I use it to describe an event that you can't unpick, that you cannot unexplain, you cannot unsee, you cannot unlearn. So the examples I gave in the book are, you don't need to do this if you've had Discovery Channel come through your house to do a show about ghosts. You don't have to do it if you've been abducted by aliens. The events, and this is a classic kind of shape of initiation throughout most of the world and most of history, that they aren't benign experiences. They're quite traumatic, trauma being very good at you know, altering consciousness, which is why it's used by psychopaths to manipulate people. In this case, it you know, puts you in a space where you can have an experience of the spirit world or something about the universe that makes it permanently magical, to the point where you may stop practicing magic, but that you will still be then a non-practicing magician. You won't be a magician afterwards. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by becoming invincible. And I kind of put it towards the front of the book, because once you have secured for yourself that unshakable awareness that this isn't all there is to things, that, you know, the physical and your silly little job and your shitty car and everything isn't all there is to it, it suddenly changes everything about how you approach the game, because the world ends and you don't. And that's where the invincibility is. The invincibility is in finding a permanent reserve of not even courage, but just a permanent reserve of invincibility that can get you through and kind of bolster you as you perform tasks that you don't necessarily want to do as they're, you know, on the way to doing other stuff. We've all had shit jobs. We've all had things we don't want to do, or we've all had catastrophic failures or been passed over for something that we thought we were definitely going to get. And all these kind of things become relativized once you've achieved that invincibility.
Do you sort of make any extrapolations or kind of draw any larger implications from that, or are you sort of content to like leave it with, you know, it is a capability that will serve you well, you know, in a day-to-day capacity?
Yeah, so for me, initiation is binary, and it's because, I mean, if you think about the previous book, it's because I have a preference for interpreting magic based on kind of like the earliest shape of what we can see. And I admit that's a preference. I think it says something very valuable about the shape of magic, and I don't think we do it enough because we've been scared off at it and saying it's, you know, tribalism or noble savage stuff. And you've read Starships, you know, and that's not actually what I think about people who lived in the Paleolithic. So I can dispense that. But if we're talking about an archetypal to the point of being almost stereotypical, if you're talking about a shamanic initiation, some kind of event like a vision quest or a spirit quest, as I stray dangerously into blurring different cultures, but you know what I mean. It's binary. The event is binary. You go and get the experience in the spirit world, be that, you know, you kind of acquire your spirit companions in return, whatever it is. You get better at magic, so that's kind of day one as Greg the baby shaman. You get better at it as you do it, no question. But that event is binary. Now we have, and again, it's that Masonic shape, and it's just things humans do. We build these fruity and unnecessary structures because we're kind of, it's very difficult to escape the politics of humanity. I'm a better wizard than you. I'm at this grade. Like, you know, that funny Star Trek cult shape to things. And if that's your jam, go for it. But initiation for most of human history has been a binary event. And if you want to arbitrarily match your progression through magical competency to grades or numbers or aprons, and that's your jam, you know, good luck to you. That's just, it's not my jam. And so that for me is, I think, the wider, I think that is the wider implications, that the experience is always binary. You sort of, not that it's enlightenment, but like you only get enlightened once. You can achieve that same state again many, many times, but it's on or off.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is a important question. Why psychedelics?
Yeah, that's a very important question. One of the reasons that's an important question is because we don't actually know why. There aren't too many, so going back to the materialist science thing, there aren't too many evolutionary advantages to the extreme potency of psychoactive compounds found in plants and fungi that contain them. Mild ones, yes, they're part of the sort of propagation cycle. You find elephants will eat certain flowers that ferment in their stomach and get them drunk, and then they'll go and defecate elsewhere, and it kind of incorporates itself into the plant's life cycle. There are some that's not the case for, and obviously the famous one and kind of overly famous at the moment is ayahuasca, because it's a combination of two different plants from the most biodiverse place in the world that... One contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, and the other one actually contains the hallucinogen. So you put those two together, and you have the most potent you activate or enable the most potent psychoactive compound on Earth to work in the human nervous system. And as to how those two things came together, the indigenous story is the spirits told them to put these two things together, and this is how we journey to the spirit world. So at the very beginning of the why question with psychedelics is because they're weird from the beginning. Terence McKenna half believed that the psilocybin mushroom came from space. And it's technically possible because as a spore, it can certainly survive in chunks of ice or, you know, dirty rocks or whatever is out there. So he half believed that it came from space. So odd is it in the context of fungal molecules, because it's so creepily simple and does all these things, but also the experiences upon taking them were one of engaging with a mushroom spirit and kind of exploring space and having sort of alien events happen. So he's like, well, it could have come from space. So to answer your question, why psychedelics? At the very beginning, it's weird. And it's that is echoed through the creation mythologies of the world, the most famous one being the tree in the Garden of Eden. But there is always some kind of taboo component about humans achieving something that, you know, they consume and then this sort of thing happens. So there's a question mark as to how and why. I like it, again, for the same reason that I think a number of, I think accidental, at least initially, accidental ingestion of naturally occurring psychoactives contributed to, like, the development of cultural complexity in humans over the last 2 million years. So, and I think it's in a spirit model sense, because we kind of accidentally found a telephone and picked it up and there was someone on the other end to conflate it down. So that's why. And there is, again, coming back to a hypothetical Paleolithic shape, this is how we did it. Like, let's be clear. This is how we've done it for what appears to be tens of millennia. Doing the research for starships, I went back through the kind of 1950s kind of mycological expeditions around the world. And the distribution of psilocybin-containing mushrooms is nowhere near located, like, you know, confined to Central America and the sort of top of South America. It's very widespread, and it appears in the highest density in some very interesting areas like island Southeast Asia and, of course, Central America and so on. So there is an opportunity, if done in the correct setting, to kind of align yourself with a very old current, and not 1880s old, you know, 180s old. And that's personally very compelling. You have to do it in the right situation, of course. Most people end up consuming them initially recreationally, which is fine in some cases. But if you get it right and in the right ritual environment, and in ayahuasca's case, I would recommend, you know, a jungle visit. That's not necessarily, you don't need to do that with psilocybin. If you're a practicing magician, you can consume that in a respectful ritual environment, and you'll get better results than if you just took it at a party or at a nightclub, even though that's still kind of fun. So I guess that's it for why. I think it is, we have, as magicians and particularly witches, we've taken too long to kind of step out of the squeamishness of the kind of witch cults, well, the modern witch cults, Edwardian founders, who just kind of liked nudity and fake harvest festivals. Because this is what we did. Like, you know, the witch at the end of the village cooked up the poisons that, you know, caused miscarriage. So, you know, the herbal abortion. The witch was always the one with the poisonous skills and the healing skills with these plants. And from an animist perspective, these are very potent allies. And I didn't necessarily go into that from a details perspective. There's some legal reasons why, particularly with a book, that you can't actually recommend someone break the law. So you'll notice in the book I say, go here into this country to do this, or go to these states to do this. Because we can do that now. It's kind of like the fact that the remaining accumulated knowledge of the classical world is now available to you for free on your phone. The opportunity to combine that, so best practice information about Eleusis with buying buying the analogs of what we think they were using there. So that was probably lysergic acid derived from ergot. So you can kind of put these things together and go to a place where it's legal and safe and do it. And that's an opportunity we haven't had before either. So I kind of hope people run with that and experiment and let me know, and let me know how much it costs. For me, that's a big thing. It's not, nothing's mandatory, but it's almost like it is. Not in that sense. Like, nothing is technically mandatory. You may have an allergy or, you know, a contraindicated medication, but even then, I'd push you on exactly where that medication is, because this is what it is. Like, again, the Terence McKenna quote that I quite like is, the shaman without psychedelics is like a stunt pilot without an aeroplane. Like, that's what it is. Yeah, you know, pick something else. So for me, I think it's quite important that we table that and normalize that rather than kind of inheriting the "this is your drain on brain on drugs" propaganda, which was garbage in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is interesting because I could see this from many different kind of perspectives. Certainly from the perspective you approach it in and the way the book is written, it totally makes logical sense. It's definitely consistent with your point of view. I think my curiosity like stems from like instances where I've heard of Eastern gurus or practitioners who ingested these substances, sometimes extreme amounts, and seem to have like no reaction whatsoever to them. And I'm wondering, like, do you have any kind of a, I don't know, rationalization or what's going on in those type of situations?
A lot of it's dosage. A lot of it can be what you bring to it. In if you do the ayahuasca thing right, you're given sort of dietary protocols to follow for the several weeks beforehand. And if you don't do it, like, that's part of the journey. Like, that you're going to get it to work if you do it right and in the right situation, especially when you're dealing with people who've been, you know, they've been doing this for longer than there have been countries in Europe. So it's probably that person's fault in that case. Like, there are rare instances perhaps, but again, it's inexact. Take more, do it again, you know. That being said, like, I mean, I kind of mentioned the psychedelia stuff in passing on the way to talking about the headless rite, which is the sort of inevitable, not necessarily conclusion, but I was very pleased to see that people realize why I put the headless rite in Chaos Protocols after having written Starships. But you don't necessarily have to. If it doesn't work, there could be something. Everyone's different in that sense. But mostly when I hear people say it doesn't work for me or everyone's different, it's a fear response. Like, you have these anecdotal stories or people won't do it right. I was watching on the weekend, I don't know if you've seen it on Netflix, the Chelsea Handler series, and the episode Chelsea Does Drugs. And she goes to the Amazon to do this, but they're drinking beforehand. She didn't get an effect. So it's a bit nervous and not wanting to do it beforehand, and they were drinking and she didn't obey the dietary rules beforehand and she didn't get any effect and did it again and, you know, got the throw up and what have you. Now that's her fault. That's not the ayahuasca. So when you have people say it didn't work, there are questions you can ask afterwards.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about working with the dead, and why did you debate including it in your book?
When Alicia and I were kind of talking about the shape of the book, I explicitly did not want it to be a chaos magic book or anything like that. I find there are, and it doesn't happen for a while, but I'm sure you would have read them as well as a kid or kind of coming up. There's some sort of hilarious, monumental arrogance in a how-to book about an entire religion, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to avoid any prescriptions to do with mandatory spirit beings in any way, because I was really trying to distance myself from the shape of a how-to book. And probably the most mandatory thing in there is ancestral engagement. Again, it comes back to, we now have the opportunity in the last, you know, 15 or so years to kind of observe in a hopefully non-racist, but still, you know, well, definitely non-racist, but there are still delicacies about how we engage with the information. But there are shapes that are emerging on a planetary basis of how this stuff may or may not work once you fold in the historical information and phenomenological data and so on. And a really key one is, the dead in general, but ancestors in particular. And there's something at the very beginning of ancestors that is sort of like the origins of the gods. I went to, what was it? What day is this? So on Monday, there was a lecture at the British Museum I went to about the Polynesian creator god, A'a. And it's a It's this amazing statue that was acquired, you know, inevitably by British missionaries in the 1800s from an island in Polynesia. It's this remarkable statue, and the back of it kind of opens, so it's sort of this 1.5 foot tall carved sandalwood creator god, and these what, and it's covered in little tiny other human figures, and in the back of it opens, and it's just the right shape for the human long bones and a skull. And so here's a creator god that probably had ancestral bones in it. Now, that's really interesting to me because at the beginning of the saintly tradition, so St. George didn't exist as a person, but his sacred sites appear to be the graves of sort of like a popular and successful warlord. So we have this blending of ancestors and gods at the very, very beginning. And I find that hugely interesting and kind of tantalizing in its implications. But from a practical perspective, this is why this stuff landed in the book. After doing regular, when I broke down where I think the probability enhancement kind of ongoing effects are, on a macro level, you can say it's Jason Millerwood offerings. On a slightly less macro level, the one that seems to have worked the best is kind of regular acknowledgement offerings, engagement, whatever you want to call it, with the ancestors. So it's kind of obscenely reductionist to say working with the ancestors is luck magic, but it is. things seem to go your way slightly better once you start to have that ongoing engagement with dead people who would presumably be predisposed to you. And even the ones that aren't, you can either ignore like the really bad ones, because I certainly acknowledge that, you know, families are dicks. but even beyond that, if you had challenging, you know, grandparents or great-grandparents that you may not have met that have clearly messed up the family down there, there's something really... I left this out of the book, but there's something very indicative about how that can kind of cool or fix or reset some kind of like bloodline imbalances. And you'll find that there's, you will observe that that manifests as kind of like less trauma in your life. And that's kind of our job. That's what magicians or people, whatever word you want to use for it, that's sort of what we've done. And that appears to be what Neanderthal versions of us did. That appears to be the thing that seems to help quite a bit. And so I had to put it in because it's almost like I got in on a technicality. It's a religious belief, which I didn't want to put in there. It's a personal belief of mine that I didn't, you know, I don't support with data or anything other than anecdotes. I'm just like, this is a belief of mine that I now recommend you do. Tried to avoid it. It got in on the technicality, which is, I can call it luck magic. But the response has been very good. I had some questions as well. Funnily enough, people involved in the book were actually adopted. So I said, do I need to put an adopted bit in? And I got straight back, some of the people involved in this book are adopted. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll put that piece in. But kind of navigating how you say things about people's families was interesting. And the feedback's been very positive. People seem to resonate with the idea or recognize it because they're already doing it.
Yeah, no, I was glad to see it in there. And I was, to me, it was like a no-brainer. I felt like, you know, if you're talking about, like you said, increasing your probability for success, like this is definitely a key part of doing that. And to me, it was a perfect fit. Yeah.
And you're sort of asking questions that, I tell you what, let me put it this way. So Scarlet Imprint books deal with, you know, the top of the magical pyramid, people who aren't new, who are interested in moving ideas forward and so on. And that's amazing. And that was a great journey. And when I was going backwards and forwards with Llewellyn, because people have formed a negative opinion of them because people tend to forget that once they were new as well.
Yeah, right.
So, like, I don't have a problem with people being new. I had to be told, like, this is what was wonderful about the editing process, because my editor would come back and tell me, like, you need to realize that I know you say that this won't be the first book people read, but what if it is? Or what if it's the second book? And so I, for me, it was a no-brainer as well. I thought I could just kind of launch into a bit more of the esoterics of ancestors. And I got pulled back down to, no, table this is an idea. And that's been good. So new people have been like, okay, either I was doing this and I sort of feel validated that this is the right thing to be doing for me, or people are like, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. I'm quite excited by it. And yeah, that's been pleasing.
Gordon White, thank you so much. The book is The Chaos Protocols, Magical Techniques for Navigating the New Economic Reality. Your website is runesoup.com. Maybe before we depart, you might share with people listening just a brief few words about your conversation with Jason Miller. I know you and he are friends, and you both are highly regarded, and you both have now got books on success, wealth, magic, although I don't think they're comparable myself, but I think it's interesting that you were talking about them.
Well, so Jason and I have been friends for a number of years now. Like, I've been to New Jersey and we've hung out and all that kind of thing. I'm just trying to work out, I was guessing that by the time this episode came out, that basically there's a video conversation that Jason and I had last night that's up on my YouTube channel. So obviously it's the most recent recorded conversation. It was top of mind for this one. So that's what I meant by when, you know, Jason and I were chatting. But if people are interested, yeah, you can find it on Rune Soup and obviously find the YouTube page there, or just, you know, go to YouTube and type in Rune Soup.
Yeah, and I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes. So thank you.
Nice.
Very cool. I want to check that out. So thank you, Gordon White, again.
You're very welcome. Always a pleasure.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Gordon White and I continue the interview, focusing on specific magical techniques and rituals that he recommends. Don't miss that crucial conversation. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. It's the best way to support the podcast while receiving access to a tremendous amount of additional exclusive content. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.